Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before we get started, I do want to thank our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by OneCause, the presenting sponsor of RAISE, the event fundraising conference. OneCause invites you to join them at RAISE, being held this year in Washington, D.C. on September 14th and 15th. RAISE brings together hundreds of fundraising professionals, industry experts and nonprofit speakers to share insights and network with others innovating in the world of fundraising. To join the community of fearless fundraisers attending RAISE and to learn more about the conference, please visit www.onecause.com/responsive50. That's www.onecause.com/responsive50. Hi, Leslie. Thank you for coming back today for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We spent about a half hour talking about really big things, and I took us in all sorts of places and somewhat disregarded the fact that we were supposed to be talking about your research. So let's really get into what it is you have uncovered. Before you do that, Leslie, would you mind just introducing yourself again to our listeners?
Oh, great. Okay. I'll try and make a difference this time. My name is Leslie Alborough. I'm a researcher, and as we discussed last time, a wannabe pre-academic, here at the University of Kent in the UK, in gorgeous Canterbury. My aim here is to research what fundraisers actually do in their day-to-day lives and try and uncover ways in which we can help fundraisers improve their practice and their connection with their donors and their beneficiaries.
So what's the name of the thesis? Give us that, and we'll just dive right into it.
Okay, so the long title is Fundraisers and the Mediated Gift, Investigating the Role of Fundraising and Gift Giving in Nonprofit Organizations. The aim was to try and uncover the invisible practices and the day-to-day practices that fundraisers engage with in their organizations and in asking donors for gifts, with a view to kind of expanding on and debunking some of the fundraising is technical or fundraising is a dark art kind of dichotomy that we're often faced with when we read about fundraising in the literature, or we engage with, say, our trustees, who also seem to think that somehow we've got a magic pot of donors that we just pick up the phone to and say, give us money, and hit voila, money appears from somewhere.
That's a really good framing. The idea, like for instance, the notion that fundraising is in some ways a dark art. For example, I said on the previous recording the idea that you're much more eloquent on things than I might be. You've got better words as an academician. So unpack that some more. Tension there between those two sort of dichotomies, that the way that sort of the world sees fundraising, apparently.
Yeah. So we've got to understand that what the world understands fundraising to be is how they engage with fundraising. So they are either the one of the millions of donors across the world who are constantly asked to either give money through a bucket being shaked in their faces, or through an appeal coming in through their front door, or increasingly an email, or on their Facebook pages, or their Twitter. And now I'm going to show my age because I don't know what the other social media platforms are. or as a major giver, where somebody's probably engaged with you in a very meaningful manner. And it probably wasn't actually the fundraiser, but probably the CEO or the project manager or an artist in the organization you're seeking to support. And those people are engaging with the fundraiser in a way that they are being told by the fundraiser, this is your donor, this is what your donor wants to hear from you, this is how you talk to your donor, say this, say that. And I think often organizational staff kind of think, well, how do fundraisers know this? Where do they find this information out? Do they have a crystal ball? You know, that sort of thing. And I think that's where the notion of the dark art comes from. But that's coupled with this idea that, you know, we're asking for money and we're exploiting people and we're manipulating people. So therefore, that's the dark bit. So it's definitely an art, but everybody kind of suspects they're somehow being hoodwinked. Certainly a lot of the literature doesn't help with that. There are pieces of research and philosophy out there. So one that stands out is Frank Rosso, who wrote, back in the 80s, developing a philosophy of fundraising, which is about encouraging generosity, facilitating gift giving, that fundraising has no purpose or moral standing outside of the mission. And I think what he was trying to do was trying to bring fundraising out into the light. But I think in many ways, that's just made it more mysterious and more mysterious sounding, that it's done by these group of people who have a way and a knowledge with other groups of people to try and get them to behave in a certain way that they don't really want to, which is an unfortunate place for fundraising to be in, because it means that I don't think fundraising is something everybody can do, but I think it's something that probably that people might have the skill set to do, and they just need a little bit of encouragement, because it's about talking to people. It's about telling people about your story and then understanding who they are and then bringing them into a space of understanding who you are and then maybe finding a space where you can support each other. Or it's this highly technical direct marketing approach, which isn't fundraising in my mind. That's kind of telling people, you know, it's mass marketing, and it works and it helps us get a lot of money on board and it helps us recruit lots of donors. But I'm not quite sure that it's serving the purpose that fundraising claims it is serving, and being facilitators of generosity and relationship builders. Genuine relationship building.
It's interesting that you bring up the idea of mass marketing and direct response, and sort of the pragmatism that the idea that it works. That's one of those isms that you and I, we like isms. I have figured out. You and I are both pretty good with those. Has part of your research sort of revealed sort of the pragmatism that has sort of informed everything that we're doing in sort of a very, very utilitarian sort of way, to the point where now we're sort of becoming more reflective and introspective, and is that sort of where we're at now, or are we still a long way off where we can get beyond the what we do what works?
I think we're a long way off we do what works, largely because I spoke directly with fundraisers, and I spoke with fundraisers and I spent quite a lot of time with them, and I went to their places of work, and I also spoke to people they worked with. So I asked them to let me speak to their colleagues about their fundraising practice as well. And what fundraisers and staff, but mostly fundraisers, were saying is, I don't actually know what I'm doing. There must be this big magic pot of knowledge out there, because I don't follow the pathway that is in the fundraising textbooks. And very few of the fundraisers I talk to actually engage in mass marketing. They engage in the marketing, mass marketing, direct marketing process, some of them, but they're also going, but I also know that I'm supposed to be building this meaningful relationship with this person. But there are 4,500 of them and one of me. So how do I do that? But then we then go, well, what appears to work is sending out one appeal after another and thinking about developing the supporter journey or your impact chart. And so there's a pragmatism that's saying, well, I have to reach an income target, because if I don't reach that income target, the people I work with are going to lose their jobs. The money's not going to come in. I don't know if I'm answering this question very well, but there is there's a huge tension about bringing the money in and bringing it consistently and being told by definitely the fundraising textbooks and other fundraisers that the mass marketing mix is part of fundraising. But we can't stop doing that because we know that works, and we don't know which bit of the fundraising mix doesn't work. So we're just not going to stop it. But at the same time, I know I've got to move everybody up the pyramid and get them to give me a big gift, and that requires relationship building, but I'm only one of me and I don't know how to do that. So I'm going to pick up the fundraising how to text and I'm going to follow that. Or I'm going to go to a quick introduction to fundraising course and I'll follow that. And that will help me become a better fundraiser.
So how do we get beyond that? Because I think that's what you and I and others are trying to sort of push. With all the best of intentions, though, sometimes especially an individual like myself, who's not terribly eloquent on this stuff, tends to become sort of a critic, received as almost like a heretic or a, you know, like just using direct response as an example. I see the usefulness of some of always the necessity of a new acquisition strategy. We always are going to need some methodology of acquiring the first time gift. And in the long term, that particular methodology is not usually going to serve the relationship very well.
Yeah.
But that, even that little nugget of thought is a little more eloquent than the way some people have sort of perceived what it is I'm out there saying.
Yeah.
So how do we get, but I also don't think that it needs to be the experts and the gurus necessarily that are always sort of saying these things. So I don't want to be that person who's sort of put up on a pedestal and saying this. I want the frontline fundraiser to think critically about this stuff.
Yeah.
In the fundraisers that you were talking to in your research, what percentage of them would you say are actually thinking critically like this?
I would say about half of them.
Okay. Yeah.
This is the one thing that I was very heartened about fundraisers is that give them the space to think critically and they'll do so.
Okay.
And that's what the research process, when you sit them down in an interview room and say, we've got 1 to 3 hours to talk about this, talk. They do. but then I think most of them walk out of that room and it's a complex problem in that we first have to let the world know we're out there and what our organization is doing. And that's marketing. That is, or what we call marketing these days. So there's an element, as you say, that is kind of needed to bring donors on board. We're trying to build relationships and connections with people who don't necessarily have a relationship or connection with us. So, or didn't even know that they wanted one with us. So I tell you, I give to organizations and that gives me access to groups of people I would never meet in my day-to-day existence. And so that's what giving to charity kind of allows. So fundraisers have to step over this huge chasm of trying to bring people on board and then build a relationship with them. But it's not a natural relationship. It's not a friendship. And often it's going to happen through mediums like direct fundraising or email, and increasingly social media. I think we don't really know how relationships work over social media yet to kind of really get to grips with them. And so fundraisers also have to balance the power of big donors. So we tend to then, Whether we like it or not, people with money have more power and more say. And in the fundraising process, because it makes more sense to invest in one asking process of a £50,000, there's far less effort. Well, not effort, but But, you know, £50,000 is probably in one shot is going to probably be easier to secure and quicker to secure than £50,000 via asking 50,000 people to give a pound or a donor. But the problem is to keep those donors who have money, who have power, who want to buy an experience, and they do. They want to buy a very special gift for the beneficiary, a life-changing gift for the beneficiary. That, you know, that's what a donor's doing. They're not giving a gift. They're buying something that they will give to somebody else through you, the organization. But in an effort to kind of look after those relationships, we are privileging those donors and we are privileging their voices. But fundraisers constantly, certainly the fundraisers I spoke to were going, but my other donors are just as important. They deserve just as much attention. They deserve just as much relationship because they're giving just as much actually in, you know, in relative terms. And so fundraisers were finding themselves in this space where, you know, they've got this problem of trying to balance the needs of various types of donors, but also then also balance the needs of their organization and making sure that their organization and what their organization is trying to do doesn't disappear in this effort to try and get these donors to come on board and attract these donors. And so it's this highly emotional, tricky process that I think fundraisers, and I have a suspicion we probably see it in the medical profession or similar, where you to a certain extent have to park your emotions and your feelings about a process in order to solve the problem, in order to bring in the donation, in order to operate on someone. You've got to surely, as a surgeon, put aside that you are cutting into a human body, kind of thing. It's really difficult and a really tricky space to be in. But at the same time, I think my fundraisers were telling me, and it certainly was reflected back in me with the conversations I was having with organizational staff, is that they staff and frontline staff don't understand that. They don't understand or know or engage with how much emotion needs to be put into the fundraising process. And they certainly don't engage with donors as human beings.
Okay. So going back to the question of these two categories of donors, those who sort of are okay with sort of thinking critically. So talk to me about those that you were talking to who were on the less sort of critically aware side, but more receptive to learning how and sort of beginning that process.
Okay.
Does that make sense? It's those people who, because these tend to be the ones that I'm still trying to figure out some of my own messaging for example. Look, I mean, those of us who sort of can sort of exist in a world where we can sort of look at something and immediately sort of critique it, I guess you could say. Those are some tough people. They've got thick skin. They can handle it, right? That's not my audience. I want to know that category of, say, the half of those people that you were talking to that are not thinking critically but are receptive to it and are not going to put up their fist when you start asking them the hard questions.
Oh, that's quite a difficult one, because those people, when I did ask questions like you know, in research, we try to be as objective in our questions as possible. So there was, and the research and the interview space isn't about critiquing them. But I think I'll use one organization of a fundraiser who'd come from an organization where, and in a major gifts team, where they were able to think very deeply and critically about their practice, and then moved over to an organization who's a very successful fundraising organization here in the UK, and they raise billions of pounds every year, but they do so largely through direct marketing, which is unusual. But they were trying to develop a mid-level and a major donor program, and she was to try and look at the mid-level process. And so she very quickly had to get to the point where she was taking on board how this organization did their fundraising, and that's just how it was done. Yet she wanted to learn how you take the mass of all these donors and maybe take a few of them and develop a close relationship with them.
Yeah.
I think the problem is that they don't want to go there. It's just that they've got this pressure of they've got to keep the income levels coming in. They've got the pressure of all the narratives telling them that this is what works. It's going to be a very quiet revolution, and it's going to be a very slow revolution. And I think it's easy for you and me to stand there and go, well, this needs to change. but when you are completely dependent on mass marketing and those mass relationships and those very shallow relationships for your fundraising income, it's really difficult to make that shift into those deeper relationships, even if you know. I think in the heart of hearts, most fundraisers know that it's in the deeper relationships that we're going to become more sustainable. I've just had a conversation recently with a foundation who are transitioning while they're spending out. So they're trying to help all their partners and the people they funded for a long time develop sustainable fundraising and what they call strategic fundraising processes. And their go-to is to employ a bunch of business and marketeer managers and to teach them how to bring in funding. And I think that's where most fundraisers, new fundraisers, come into organizations, and that's what they're taught. So it's a very hard space for them to question that and be critical of that, because their jobs are on the line, as well as their own credibility, as well as, they believe, generating income. So I don't know. I don't know what we do about it, except keep talking about it and keep listening to fundraisers and then trying to find solutions for them within that space, or working with them to those solutions.
An individual reached out to me recently, and they said, this was a fan. She had read my book 2 years ago, and she said, I believe all of this stuff, but I have spent, I'm 20 years into this, and I don't know how to take somebody out to lunch. And it was almost like she was, she got on the phone with me, she sort of set it up as if I was some sort of priest and she was making a confession, and she sort of confessed that she had sort of in our ongoing dialogue, because we had a series of conversations, we've become good friends, I would say. She didn't want to disclose to me that every time that we had interacted, every time I was suggesting, fundraisers need to learn how to take people out to lunch, she didn't want to sort of come clean on the idea that she didn't know how to do that. And I feel like that's sort of the individual that, that I'm sort of, asking you, I think in our previous recording in earlier this week when we were talking, yeah, you referred to sort of this naive understanding of how all this works and right, what it is we're doing and stuff. And what I see this woman sort of representing in this sort of framework is that less naive, but still very fearful and hesitant of sort of letting go of what has become her professional identity.
And I think if I'm being the reflective researcher I claim to be, I've got to hold my hand up and say that certainly in my own fundraising practice, I think I made 2 face-to-face asks ever. So I got very proficient at setting that up via someone else. So I got very good at managing the relationship from behind the scenes.
Yep.
So the actual and I saw a lot of this in the interviews with fundraisers that I was talking with, and with those staff members who did participate in the fundraising process and got it. So one CEO was very good at it. He realized as a CEO that he was the relationship holder. The donors believed the relationship to be with him, and he did. So he very proactively sought to build relationships with them, but that the fundraiser was the one at the other, was behind the scenes being almost looking after the hygiene factors for that relationship. And that's why I say it's not a natural friendship or relationship. It's one that has a very clear outcome. Sorry, my phone's going. I'm just switching that off. A very clear outcome. And that is a gift at the end of it. And for the donor, that the outcome is not necessarily the gift. The outcome is how I felt about it and what I gained from that gift, or the person, the beneficiary gained from that gift. But what we're saying is we're trying to teach fundraisers that they've got to be everything. So they've got to be these amazing technical experts. They've got to be able to write great copy. They've got to be able to find all these case studies and reframe them. And they've got to be the kind of person who's good at taking someone out to lunch. And sometimes I think maybe we need to give fundraisers the space to say, well, maybe you've got to be good at finding the person in your organization that's good at taking people out to lunch.
Yeah, there's a great book. There's a great book that I can't think of his name, but the name of the book here that was written here in a higher education circles, the chief development officer, or whatever. The chief development officer, and the author describes that individual as being a chief strategist, in that they know how to position. They don't necessarily have to be always the one at the lunch table, and they don't necessarily have to be terribly eloquent at making the ask. They have to know how to make sure that somebody's at the lunch table pretty consistently with the right people. Let me ask you a question. I literally have three books sitting in front of me. My desk looks like a mad professor or whatever, but these three books, I haven't even cracked them, but they're all about reciprocity.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, because you use the word gift in your, in your research and in your title. Does the word gift, I wouldn't even know if I open up these books about reciprocity. Does reciprocity necessarily hinge on the word gift so much? And are there other ways for us to understand our work that maybe the idea of gift giving and gift receiving doesn't really do us a lot of service?
Okay. Well, it depends how you look at the gift.
Yeah, okay.
What you think a gift is. So I take a very Malthusian perspective of gift giving. So Sal Mauss, who way back in the 1920s, came up with this concept that we have an obligation to give in life. We have an obligation to receive those gifts well. And then we have the obligation to reciprocate those gifts.
Yep.
So it's the obligatory gift. So it's not the altruistic gift. So I very much form in the understanding of gift, that gift giving is a process of building solidarity and social connection. And in order to do that, there has to be a reciprocal process in it, because as soon as there's no reciprocation, it's just an altruistic act, I suppose, or just giving something away. For me, what turns it into a gift is the reciprocity, is the feedback. And it very much, there's a lot of philosophical writing on this. Derrida, for instance, says that the idea of the gift is impossible, because as soon as you recognize it as a gift, it stops being a gift. It's an interesting sort of narrative to get into. So I think you can take on reciprocity from a perspective that sort of Alvin Goldner takes on. He wrote in the 1960s and 70s, where reciprocity doesn't necessarily have to be in gift giving, but it can be in social interactions. So you can't have a social interaction unless I reciprocate your opening gambit. I have to say something and then you reciprocate back to me. And there's that sense of reciprocity. I don't think he goes away with the idea of giving, necessarily, in his ideas of reciprocity. They're such laden terms, but I think our understanding, and certainly the kind of gifting practice we practice in philanthropy and fundraising, requires reciprocation of some definition, whether it's serial reciprocity or such as Michael Moody might describe. So we see it in notions of passing it forward or paying it forward. But we certainly, and this is what I think we've lost in a lot of the fundraising and understanding of charitable gift giving, or we see it as some sort of altruistic act that doesn't require a response from the organization or the beneficiary. But what I was seeing my fundraisers were certainly telling me is that you do, And that burden is falling to fundraisers in organizations.
Well, are you getting at the idea that but one of the things I have oftentimes said to clients is that fundraising isn't really about giving well, it's about receiving well. And I don't know, I mean, maybe I'm sitting here sort of conjuring up to what the book that you and I are going to write together, and it's the idea of fundraising. You know, we've got to learn how to be better receivers.
Yeah.
And I think that tends to be sort of where we fall off, is that we get, we sort of compartmentalize giving and receiving separately. We get fascinated.
Yeah.
We appreciate the idea. We like to be givers ourselves.
Yeah.
But I mean, who likes to be on the receiving end of anything? Because it oftentimes comes with the fear that it comes with strings attached, or
exactly. Obligations. You know,
obligation or something. Yeah. Or the idea that I got to pay this back. I mean, I live here in central Pennsylvania in a small old industrial town that, you know, 10 or 12 lucky people were the people who were giving and giving for decades. And everybody, you know, if that rich white guy gave to your, you know, to your charity, you were now obligated to give to his charity later.
Yeah.
And so it was the receiving that became really sort of dysfunctional for several decades here in this community.
And I think that it can, and it's in that the receiving and how do you receive well, that certainly if you step into the gift theory literature, which is largely anthropological and philosophical writing, is that idea. Emerson writes about it, that the notion of giving a gift and then receiving it means you're signing up to the notion of reciprocity. But particularly in the charitable world, most of our beneficiaries, who, if we're honest, that's who donors are giving to. They're giving to this notion of the beneficiary in their mind, aren't in a position to reciprocate in an equal manner, in a way that is either the same amount of money or socially the same. So what we've done with the organization kind of relieves that reciprocal burden a little bit from the beneficiary, but then we think that a thank you letter will suffice. But that's not reciprocation. That's saying, oh, we got your gift. Shot. You know, now we're going to do something for it. But the part of the reciprocation is letting the donor know, or giving the donor something to let them know that they've achieved what they wanted with their gift, even if it was just to feel good, even if it was just to do something good in life. The reciprocal thing that we bring along as fundraisers and as organizations is to say, this has been achieved, or it hasn't been achieved in this way, but, you know, when you gave us this gift, you opened up the space for us to interact with you, and that's what we're going to do. So reciprocity is really difficult. I mean, my examiner for my PhD thinks that reciprocity is like for like, and it's an actual physical thing, whereas I think it can be a feeling or regard. Offer writes about it that it's about giving regard to someone for the act that they've engaged in. And yes, that does set up lots of ties of obligation, but it's in those ties of obligation that we build community and we build society and we build social connection. And yes, they can be bad and inequitable connections. And I think we have to be careful about what negative sort of reciprocity we set up, both in the fundraising process and in our everyday life. So, for instance, if someone is giving you a leg up in the world, so in other words, I don't know if that's a appropriate term.
America.
Okay, yep. That's fine. It just occurred to me. But has given you a chance at a job. You need to reciprocate that and be thankful for it and give them something in return, and that is to do your job well and do it to the best of your ability and learn as much as you can. But it's not to be completely tied to that person and become a mini version of them, because then that becomes negative reciprocity. Yeah. So I think I think I really like the idea of understanding that reciprocity is something that helps the fundraising process become better and more moral and more ethical and kinder to each group of people. But what we've done and we've tended to do is leave that burden on the fundraiser, who becomes almost a reciprocity mediator. We don't close the loop properly enough, and which means we leave donors dissatisfied or giving donors too much space and too much power, or we somehow do our beneficiary groups out of engaging in a gifting relationship that might actually help empower them. And that's the bit where I get very concerned about, is that we tend to talk about people who receive our gifts, whether they be from the nonprofit organization or the donor. We tend to talk about them, and we tend to slip into a narrative, especially in the fundraising world, where they're part of the product or the gift that the donor is purchasing in order to give back to the beneficiary instead of the recipient of the gift, and therefore able to participate in the decision-making process about what the gift will look like.
So at the end of all of these, at the end of all of these, at the end of a project of this sort for you, there's always that opportunity to sort of say to the world what comes next and where does this go from here. So what, when you were getting this done, what were you sort of saying? What has to come next? What sort of doors were being opened up, windows, whatever the analogy fits?
So I left with far more, I'm left with far more questions than I had answers answers for it. So I think what is next for me is my research was based on talking to fundraisers who fundraise across the board. So all sorts of different kind of fundraising and fundraising from all sorts of different people. But the donor data I'm able to access, understanding about who gives and why, falls into two distinct groups. The first is we understand a lot and we research a lot about major donors, why they give, what motivates them to give, in the philanthropic literature. We understand a lot of that. But we also ask those donors to tell us about how they give, and we never ask them about their engagement with the fundraising process. So we don't really know how they're engaging with fundraisers or what they think about fundraisers. And then we tend to see most donors, so most donors who aren't giving a lot of money, we tend to research and understand their giving according to the direction of their giving. So we'll say most people give to religious charities in America, and in Myanmar it would be the Buddhist temple, for instance, or the next biggest receivers of charitable giving are cancer research charities or medical charities, and then animals. We don't understand what it is because we're not really talking to those everyday donors about why are they engaging and giving in the way that they're doing. So, and then understanding how they're engaging with the fundraising process. And I think there's a lot of research that we need to do around that, that I think can help fundraisers begin to unpick a little bit more about the practices that they can drop and the practices that they can focus on. And I'm kind of hoping that that kind of research would tell us it's the practices that we're saying are good, because that's certainly a far more fulfilling career to go into as a fundraising, isn't it? I think we also need to speak more, not just with fundraisers, because there's the burden to ask fundraisers to critically engage with their practice. And we have identified in this conversation that they are doing so. But I think we now need to ask organization staff to not just create a culture of philanthropy. Let's unpick what that is. Let's critically engage with what a culture of philanthropy is. And is that something we actually want in our organizations? Or do we just want a culture where everybody is okay with speaking with donors and beneficiaries alike and bringing them to the same table? We all just play slightly different roles. But we all know what that means and what we're signing up to when we're doing that.
Do fundraisers know, before I let you go, do fundraisers know that the really wealthy individual who we presume has a lot of power especially financial power, I guess you could say, are oftentimes intimidated by that beneficiary?
I don't know. I think we spend so much time trying to protect both the donor and the donor's privacy and the donor's process and their relationship with us, as well as trying to protect beneficiaries from being exploited, that we don't ask that question. And I think it's quite easy to sit in front of somebody who has apparent power and a lot of power, especially financial power, and not understand whether they are intimidated by a beneficiary. I think we need to ask donors. We need to speak to them more honestly about that. And maybe that's the space in which researchers can come along, because we can ask that question without compromising the gift, can't we?
Yeah, I mean, it's different. So the wealthy individual who's writing a check to, you know, ABC charity, it's one thing for them to be sitting with an individual like you or I as a fundraiser who is an agent of a charitable organization, yeah, who is basically trained to know how to sit with that individual. And I think some of the accusation and some of the ethical sort of tension that sort of gets stirred up, it's between those two.
Yeah.
And I think, I tend to think that the fundraising profession needs to sort of acknowledge that this really wealthy individual, if they were sitting across the table with a beneficiary as opposed to one of us, they'd be stumbling all over their words. I mean, it's a different type of power dynamic. But do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. And I think that donor would be acutely aware that this is a person from an environment and a background that I can't even begin to get my head around or understand.
Yeah.
Or am I going to say the wrong thing? Am I going to say the right thing? I think we assume that donors are going to be very patronizing and talk down to beneficiaries. And I don't think that necessarily follows, especially if we think about the donors that we do engage with. So I engage with a major donor. Well, I don't engage with him directly. I engage with the staff of his foundation, because he is quite clearly a little bit intimidated by the beneficiaries. In that I think he thinks they might be more clever or have more insight than he would. And if he opened his mouth up in front of them, that would be revealed. Do you know what I mean? And I do think that's often the case. And you know, facing someone who's gone through great trauma or great pain can be intimidating, because they do tend to have a very different view of the world from us, don't they? So, yeah, but I don't think we're thinking about donors in that way yet. Even as fundraisers, I think we still see them as, you know, powerful and financially stable and with it, because we still see the whole process from this business success kind of viewpoint. And maybe we need to change that a bit and kind of see if we can sometimes park the money and just approach a person as they are, or as much as they are as we can. Yeah.
I have developed a friendship over the years with a gentleman who's probably maybe the single wealthiest family in my community.
Yeah.
And at times people have asked me, you know, how do we engage with this gentleman? And I have had to say to them, do you realize that this is inherited wealth on his part? And it's actually inherited on behalf of a stepfather. It wasn't even his biological father whose money, you know, he inherited, or now has inherited the responsibility for giving it away. And I've said, do you folks realize how uncomfortable he is giving this money away? And he's never going to tell you that. He's been charged with this responsibility. He takes it on. It's not a natural process for him. He would be doing all sorts of other things if you understood who he was. But at the same time, I know this gentleman well enough to know that he also would be the same type of individual who could get into a predicament where he could be accused of being unethical. So the anxiety and the uncomfortableness that sort of gets stirred up between, you know, a beneficiary, a fundraiser, and himself, it's a messy situation. And so the fundraiser becomes this, they've got to be a facilitator of this generosity that, it's going to be a messy process, and you better know what the hell you're doing, I guess, is kind of, you know.
But what I think fundraisers largely become are gatekeepers. And that's not a comfortable space for anybody to be in, because it becomes quite aggressive and quite defensive. So you're either going to be very aggressive with your organization and your organizational staff and your beneficiaries, or you're going to be aggressive with the donor.
Yeah.
You know, because you can't really stand, you can't be a gatekeeper by standing on both sides of the gate. You're on one side or the other. And I think we have to find a way of helping fundraisers not be gatekeepers, but really be those facilitators and those mediators.
Oh, that's profound.
And
Oh, Leslie, that's a very profound thought, because that is the way that we get characterized sometimes, or that we characterize other people.
Yeah.
And if you think about even some of the convoluted, strange ways that some of us are trying to sort of reposition ourselves, being gatekeepers, as if you sort of have this strange neutral. I see this in the United Kingdom. I think you probably have some colleagues that do this. It's this idea that we can sort of be representatives of the donor now. You can't sort of position yourself in this sort of neutral.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen.
Yeah.
I don't know that we could any more be the same dysfunction that we sort of oftentimes ask ourselves about. Oh, you've got me started now. I did this a lot in the previous episode, but the same dysfunction that we oftentimes get ourselves all tied up in knots about us being on the payroll for a charitable organization is the same mess that gets created if we were on the other side.
Right. Exactly. And I think, Ostrander writes about it in a 2007 paper, where she talks about the rise of donor control. And I think she tries to grapple with that idea, but doesn't quite get there. Just because, you know, it's a paper and you never have the full picture. But this idea of it's a throwaway comment in one of Adrian Sargent's paper is this question of who does the donor serve? Who does the fundraiser serve? Do we serve the donor, or should we be employed by the donor? But then we become wealth advisors, which, you know, it's a horrible, tricky space. And I just sometimes wonder that maybe we just need to be okay with the fact that it's a horrible, tricky space, and then we're going to be having to navigate it all the time. And that maybe will then bring a level of honesty and approach that might relieve some of these tensions and allow us to go, oh, well, in this situation, is this the right thing? Is this the ethical approach? Is it as right for as many people as possible within this relationship?
I'm going to let us end right there.
Right. Because
I think we're both probably a little intellectually exhausted.
Exhausted.
Leslie, you are welcome back anytime. We have done a 2-part conversation. Remind our listeners again the name of the paper and the where they can find it.
Okay. It's Fundraisers and the Mediated Gift, and it can be found on the University of Kent library website. It should be free to access, but it isn't. Please feel free to email me. My contact details are also on the University of Kent's website. And I love receiving emails, especially from fundraisers.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. Thanks, Jason.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.